This is Bob, Graz, and Tom.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio and streaming nationwide on the 710 Sports app and 710sports.com.
Welcome to hour number three of Bob, Graz, and Tom with Graz and Tom. Having a fine Monday today.
It's almost too easy, Graz, because we got 2 weeks ahead of us here, and they won that game so convincingly against a bad team. It's kind of like, all right,
you know what?
Let's go.
It's almost, Tom, it's almost as if they had lost the game badly. We'd have felt terrible about it, right?
And we'd right.
Been, man, we're stuck talking about this for 2 weeks.
Ugh.
Because there's not a lot. There's not going to be a whole lot to talk about.
There really isn't.
I mean, after today, I mean, everything was positive. There are no negatives really to take out of the game.
Injuries? None?
None that I'm aware of.
All right, let's bring in Brady Henderson of ESPN.com right now. Brady, what do you think about that, the idea of momentum? Do you kind of wish they didn't have the bye week right now?
You know, I think that every team, if you ask any player on every team, they would always tell you that the bye week comes at a good time just because, you know, even if the team isn't, you know, even if there aren't a bunch of obvious injuries that the team is dealing with, everybody's always dealing with something. And, you know, the bye week is going to allow them to get Ed Dixon back, although he was probably going to be on track to play just because of the NFI rule. But they're also going to have a chance to get KJ right back. So, you know, momentum, yeah, you could maybe say that, you know, maybe there's a part of them that would like to kind of keep things going. But off a really long trip to London with another long flight to Detroit in a couple weeks, I think that, they're definitely fine having a bye week.
Hey, Brady, we're going to give you a call back in 1 second. Your connection is just a little bit dicey here, so I'll get DJ on that. Thanks for bearing with us. But, yeah, I'm kind of the same mind there. I think that the bye week being this early, though, is a bit of a problem. I'd much rather have it later.
And in general, you'd like to have it in week 10. I mean, you just would rather have it when you've gone through more wear, and week 10 would normally be the last bye week would be the ideal.
Right.
However, I do agree with what he said that you know, I mean, the NFL game is so tough that actually, whenever it comes, it's welcome.
Yeah, I'm sure there are some guys on there who are looking at it like, you know what, I'm a little banged. I'm not injured.
Well, KJ Wright.
Yeah, sure.
But, I mean, there's always going to be some guys who are in that circumstance, some guys who aren't. But I think most of the guys are happy when it comes. But I would say, look, in general, halfway point of the season or later is when you'd ideally like to have it.
Right.
And that'd be true of every team.
And it's not like with, say, the offensive line, for example, like all of a sudden they're going to forget what they did the past couple of weeks just because they had a week off.
No, but it's like you said, if you're a believer in momentum, this is something that derails it to a degree.
Yeah, sometimes you get hot. And are they hot? Can we call them that? They did lose the week before.
They're playing well. They played well last
They've been week. Playing well. Okay. Yeah, and you want to keep that going the best you can. Okay, so all right, so Brady's back. Brady, a guy we've been talking about all day is Frank Clark. I'm curious to know from your point of view, how does the Seahawk organization look at him and decide whether or not they want to end up paying him?
Yeah, I don't think there can be a whole lot of question about that at this point anymore. I mean, not only is he proving himself to be, you know, one of the upper-tier pass rushers in the NFL, but the other side of that is you just don't really have a ton of guys behind him. And, you know, you could have looked at Clark a few years ago as sort of a luxury, right, when you had Pro Bowlers there like Michael Bennett, Cliff Averill, even Sheldon Richardson last year.
Right.
Another guy I would compare him to is, you know, the decision they made a few years ago to let Bruce Irvin walk in free agency after the fourth year of his rookie contract. You know, you had other guys there that you didn't feel like you were going to miss Bruce Irvin that much. You just don't have that. Like, Frank Clark is your only sure thing in terms of a pass rusher. So, to me, it doesn't seem like there's much of a question, you know, in terms of whether or not they want to keep him at this point, because I don't really think they have all that much of a choice just because they don't have a ton behind him.
But it does not mean necessarily that they'll re-sign him during the season, does it?
Yeah, and the point I should have made there at the end is I think that at this point it's more so about the timing of it. And you know, to the question that you just asked, I cannot recall anything other than a couple instances where they did a big budget extension in, you know, during the season. Usually it happens, you know, with Russell Wilson, Bobby Wagner, it happened right at the start of training camp, or it happens, you know, in April or May. The two instances I can recall are Cliff Averill and KJ Wright, which were both in December of 2014. And I wonder if part of that is, you know, not so much a matter of salary cap, but a matter of just sort of the organizational finances and being, you know, right at the end of the calendar year and wanting to get that on the books in that calendar year, because inevitably you're going to be talking about, you know, a big signing bonus, which is a big, you know, lump sum upfront payment. So maybe, you know, maybe it happens there, but, you know, if you're Frank Clark and you get all the way to December, you know, maybe you think, well, okay, you know, I think players typically think of it as, look, you know, I'll take the deal before free agency because it's, you know, it's a bird in the hand, right? And they protect themselves against the risk of playing that season out and getting injured. But if Frank Clark has made it all the way to December and he hasn't gotten hurt and he's only looking at maybe three or four more games left, maybe he'd be tempted to say, okay, you know, well, I'll wait and I'll see what's out there in free agency. Of course, the other side of that is that the Seahawks could, you know, they always have the option to franchise tag him at that point. So, to me, I it seems like a matter of timing, and the timing does get interesting just because there's only been a couple of cases where they've extended a player with a big budget extension during the season.
Do you think he actually, and I'm talking about Frank Clark still, do you think he actually has made a big jump this year, or is what we saw yesterday just a result of a terrible offensive line?
I think it was definitely part of that, and Colton Miller definitely looked overmatched. But at the same time, he's a first-round pick, and at the same time, you know, Clark has basically had a sack in I think, the first four games before that. Now, the strip sack he had against the Rams last week actually didn't count, but you know, he's officially 5.5 sacks. Really, he has 6.5. So, you know, he's been doing it, and he's really been doing it for the last three seasons now, ever since the start of the 2016 season. So, I don't think that you could say anymore that this is, you know, if he just had like a really hot stretch, you could maybe say, you know, maybe he's going just against pass or you know, tackles that aren't very good. But he's been doing it too long and too often to say that. I think that he is showing, and if you look at the numbers, I think he's in the top 10 as far as since the start of the 2016 season, sacks, you know, over those last, 37 games or whatever it is. So, I think he's proven himself to be one of those upper tier pass rushers.
Not that we were looking for it, but we found it very difficult to find anything really to criticize about that game yesterday. I mean, maybe penalties, otherwise it was a complete effort, was it not?
Yeah, and I was just going to say, maybe the only thing is the penalties, and, you know, there may be kind of a sensitivity to that just because it's been such an issue for the Seahawks over the last few seasons, but that was about it. And, you know, when you're playing, when you play as good of a game, aside from that, as they did, and when you play as bad of a team as they did, that's something that you can get away with, committing eight penalties for, you know, 70 yards, whatever it was. So that was probably the only thing. I mean, look, you started fast, which is something that they have not done in a long time. The opening drive touchdown they had, it's the first time since week three of the 2016 season that they had scored a touchdown on their opening possession, and they scored a touchdown on their third possession. So, you know, they are usually notoriously slow starters on offense, and the way that they started that game was just one of several things that you had to like about that. So, I agree with you. Aside from the penalties, there was not a whole lot. Maybe, you know, some spotty tackling earlier in that game, but, you know, we're kind of picking nits there when you talk about a 24-point victory.
Talking to Brady Henderson of ESPN.com on the Venue Kings hotline. Brady, there's a handful of guys you could choose from on this, but who do you think has been the biggest difference maker from last year now into this year?
The biggest difference maker? A guy that comes to mind is Bradley McDougal. I don't know, you know, he was sort of in and out last year, really started the second half of the season because of injuries to Earl Thomas and Cam Chancellor. But, you know, in terms of, I think he has made a huge difference in terms of, you know, you kind of expected there to be a drop-off there, right? When you talk about Pro Bowl sort of franchise great players, you know, going from those guys and Thomas and Chancellor to going to a guy that you picked up on a cheap deal in free agency in McDougal. And I think that he has played he's played really well. I don't really know how to describe it, but he's making plays. He had, I think, three interceptions at this point. He's a good tackler. He's sort of playing all over the field. I would have expected there to be a bigger drop-off, especially when Earl Thomas got injured a couple weeks ago. But Bradley McDougal, you know, really as the only veteran left in that secondary, I think he's having one of the better seasons of any Seahawks so far.
How much credit does Ken Norton get for this? I mean, he's been here before. He kind of knew the territory a little bit, but he's got a lot of new guys, and And again, we're talking about one game, so you know they weren't as effective against the Rams. But to kind of knit this whole thing together the way he has so far, what's your opinion of his job?
Yeah, I think that you're spot on there, Roz. I think that he and the entire coaching staff deserve some credit. I mean, with Norton, not so much in the sense that he is bringing in a bunch of new stuff, because he's really, you know, like any coordinator that Pete Carroll has ever had in Seattle, he's really running Pete Carroll's defense. And I don't know, you know, schematically how different anything that they're doing is to what they were doing under Rashard, under Dan Quinn. So I don't know if it's so much schematically, but, you know, there was a lot of new players that they had to get ready in a hurry. And one guy that comes to mind is Trey Flowers. If I would have told you in August, in the middle of August, that you would have been starting, you know, a rookie fifth-round pick at cornerback, and not only is he a rookie fifth-round pick, but he was a guy who played safety in college, you would have thought that he would be a liability every game, that you know, quarterbacks would be picking on him. You really have not seen that, and that's got to be a testament to, you know, A, that the caliber of player that he is in the first place, but also the fact that, you know, that coaching staff had to do a really good job of getting that guy ready. So I think that in terms of, you know, credit to Ken Norton Jr., I think that definitely, yeah, along those lines, you know, he has gotten a lot of young guys, a lot of new guys, gotten those guys ready to replace a lot of really good players, and the drop-off has not been nearly as big as what you would expect it to be.
Yeah, what is it with these guys that they draft late in the draft? I mean, the seventh rounders alone with David Moore and Chris Carson, when they draft those guys, Brady, do you think that they're identifying something, a unique skill with those guys, or are they just sort of taking a chance and saying, all right, this looks okay, we can mold it into something?
Yeah, I think that when you look at guys who go that late in the draft, there's usually something that there's an imperfection about them, whether it's, you know, Carson only played 2 years at Oklahoma State. He had some injuries and he missed five games over those two seasons. And he wasn't a guy who was ever really that, like, full-time, you know, bell cow running back in college. With Trey Flowers, he was, you know, kind of an atypical body type for a safety. Really a long and slender guy. He looks more like a big cornerback than a safety. So I think when you talk about guys who are going that later in the draft, you know, it's usually there's something that teams maybe sort of that causes teams to shy away from them. And I think the Seahawks look at it as, look, you know, there's a way that we can use this guy, you know, whether it's converting Trey Flowers or, you know, other guys that they've switched positions or using him, you know, sort of in specialized roles. So, you know, I don't think that's unique to the Seahawks. I think a lot of other teams get production from late-round picks, but the Seahawks have certainly done a good job of that.
You talked about it a little bit at the beginning, but Ed Dixon, K.J. Wright, are those the two main guys to keep an eye on during this bye period?
Yeah, we'll get a better sense of that tomorrow. I think, you know, when Pete Carroll is available, definitely the expectation all along has been that Ed Dixon is going to be ready. He's been on the non-football injury list, and the rule with that is similar to PEPs, that you've got to miss the first 6 weeks. So that time has passed for him. He's going to be ready. I think physically he would have been ready to play, you know, a few weeks ago. It just, the rules would not let him. And with KJ Wright, it has sounded like that he was going to be ready when Pete Carroll said last week that he wasn't going to play Sunday in London. The point he made there was, you know, with the bye coming up, why would we not, you know, why would we rush him? Although Carroll did not mention Wright specifically yesterday when talking about the guys that they either could or we're expecting to get back, talking about Dixon and possibly J.D. McKissick. So we'll get a better sense of that tomorrow. But you know, it seems like things are looking up for them just from the health standpoint alone. You know, going two games without really suffering any significant injuries and then getting a break and now getting some reinforcements back.
Talking to Brady Henderson of ESPN.com on the Vinny Kings Hotline. Brady, we mentioned the penalties just in the context of this game, but if we just go bigger picture here for a second, what could you point to and say this is a weak point for the Seahawks? What is it, whether it's a position group or something, where do you think that they still need to improve?
Well, yeah, if you would have asked me this before yesterday, the answer would have been a lot more obvious, and it would have been the pass rush, right?
Yeah.
Because they had really, before that game, had a hard time consistently mounting any pass rush, consistently at least. And you know, to put it in perspective, they entered that game with 10 sacks over their first five games, and they had six of them yesterday, which just goes to show, you know, what kind of a day they had. So, you know, again, you know, we sort of hit on this. That was not a very good Raiders team in general and not a very good offensive line. So maybe you could chalk up some of that to the fact that, you know, they were just going against bad, you know, a bad offensive line. And, You know, so that's really the one thing that you can think of right now, just because until yesterday, we really had not seen them do that all that consistently, and they hadn't really had that guy who's shown that he can step up outside of Frank Clark, you know, to really do that. You know, Jaron Reed had three sacks before that game. He had one yesterday. So that's a good sign when you get a guy who is probably known more as a early down run stuffer, the guy who can, you know, get some pressure on the quarterback from the inside. You know, they just need to do it more consistently, but certainly a really good sign for them yesterday.
In the meantime, their running game looks week after week more and more like it's for real and one of the elite running games in the NFL.
It does, yeah. And you know, I think we're past the point of saying that, you know, this is just maybe a one or two week thing. You know, they've done it for 4 weeks now. And what they had yesterday, I think it was like 154 rushing yards. That was basically the same thing they had averaged over the previous three games. And so it's all, you know, it all seems to be fitting together for them. You know, they're staying, you know, as they say, on schedule. They're not getting behind, you know, in those unmanageable third down situations, which really preclude them from running. So they're sticking with the run, and they're actually running the ball really well. And you can see, you know, you can point to whatever reason, any number of reasons for that. Play up front, you know, the guard play with J.R. Sweezy and D.J. Fluker really just making a huge difference there. They have healthy runners now, which is something that they did not have last season. And, you know, we've talked about this. That's why they went out and they drafted Rashad Penny in the first round, just because it's been such a struggle for them to stay healthy. And, you know, save for the one game that Chris Carson missed, those guys have been healthy. So everything is really coming together for that running game. And, again, they've done it for 4 weeks now. So I think you can start to say that this is what they, you know, they may not have it every single week when you go against, you know, a better team, a better defense, and things don't really go all that well to start out the game, and you sort of have to get away from that a little bit. But we've seen enough of it for a month or for four straight games now. That's really seems like what they are as an offense.
Sure helping Russell Wilson look comfortable, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And I think it's an interesting sort of situation with Russell now. You know, you could wonder if, you know, the fact that he's only throwing the ball, I think the last four games it's been 26, 26, 21, and 23 times. You might look at that and say, well, Russell Wilson's being marginalized in their offense because they're running the ball so much. But he has, you know, look at his touchdown. He's got 8 touchdowns and only one interception, you know, over the past 4 games. He's got 13 overall, which I think puts him on pace to finish right around what he had last year, yep, which tied a career high. So, you know, Russell is, he, it's true, he does have fewer opportunities, but he is really making the most of those opportunities. And, you know, save for that interception that he had yesterday, which looked to me like a forced throw into the end zone, a throw he didn't really have to make. That was really the only careless throw, the only real mistake he's made over the past 4 games. So, you know, he's not throwing the ball as often, but he is really, you know, that is some really good efficiency that he is, you know, playing with, just because, you know, it's basically everything but the attempts and the yards that he has. You know, he's got the touchdown passes, and so that he is really making the most of a reduced number of opportunities.
Brady Henderson of ESPN.com. Thanks for jumping on, Brady, today. Short notice. I appreciate it.
You bet. Say, sorry about the reception. I was on the boat phone there.
The boat phone? Okay.
The boat phone.
I can hear the seaplanes actually flying right around his house there, too.
Yeah, they just bugged me.
Right on. All right. Thanks, Brady. Appreciate it.
You bet. Thanks, guys.
You know, he does bring up an interesting point there, too, about Russell Wilson. Can Russell Wilson, or any quarterback for that matter, be at their absolute best if everything else is functioning well around them? Because you don't have to do as much.
Yeah, that is the way you are at your absolute best.
Well,
it's hard to be your absolute best when you're running for your life and, you know, you're showing creativity and whatnot. But Aaron Rodgers has been at his absolute best when he's got things working for him.
When you're not
a chance to be ultimately efficient, to not throw inter-. I mean, like Brady said, and we talked about it earlier. Maybe only threw 24 passes or 21 passes, but 3 touchdown passes. You throw 3 a game, that's 36.
Right.
That's as many as you had when you were running the whole thing last year, when you were the only weapon on offense last year.
But you're not going to put up the 5,000 Drew Brees yards type season.
Yeah, but that's
when
not,
that's happening.
But when Drew Brees put that up, because it was because the offense was designed to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So Drew Brees, you can argue, was in the exact same spot that Russell Wilson was in. It's just that the way that their offense was about throwing the ball all the time. The way the Seahawks are about doing it is about running the ball all the time. So, and having the quarterback be efficient and getting a chance to throw long passes and play action, he's getting plenty of opportunities. I mean, there can be some guys who could be upset about it, but You're not. You know, maybe Drew Brees if the Saints changed how they were doing things, but they haven't.
Right, and it's not. Believe me, it's not a complaint by any stretch.
I
mean, you want what's the most important thing? Touchdown passes, right?
Yep.
It doesn't matter how lack of
interceptions.
Right. It doesn't matter how you get the ball up and down the field, as long as you do, and as long as the ball gets into the end zone. It just so happens that one of the things that Russell's really good at is escapability.
Well, he's going to need that. I mean, not every game is going to be as easy as the Raider game.
True.
In fact, we already know that.
Imagine if it were.
It'd be amazing. We already know that for a fact just thinking about the first two games when he was sacked 12 times.
Yeah.
And frankly, I mean, we'll see if he has the same escapability that he used to have. But he doesn't need it, and it's better not to need it.
Not at the moment. One other thing that we were talking about with Brady there, he was talking about how McDougald is somewhat of a surprise. I mean, he's not a rookie player. He's a veteran player in the league. But coming over here, I don't know if anybody thought he was going to be as good as he has been
so far. He's playing
so elite.
Nobody did.
He really is. Now,
he came here to be a backup.
Yeah. He wasn't necessarily the guy after Cam, right, necessarily.
No.
But he's turning into that right now. Now, here's the question about a guy in his position. Can anybody who follows Cam or Earl or Sherman, no matter what they do, can they be thought of as better than that guy? Can they be thought of as, can they ever outdo the achievements of Sherman or Earl or Cam? It's hard to shake that.
They can, but I mean, you're not going to make that call after five games.
No, you're not. But no matter how well he plays,
in some people's minds, he'll never be that. But I mean, those are you're setting the bar impossibly high there.
Well, look at Aaron Rodgers and following Brett Favre, Steve Young following Montana.
Yeah, how often does that happen?
Very, very rarely.
Those are two examples in 40 years.
Exactly. But even in those cases, some Packer fans are going to say Favre's better than Rodgers. It's close.
They might.
You know, but you could comfortably make a case.
Most 49er fans are not going to say Steve Young was better than Joe Montana.
That is true.
Very few would say that he's better. And that's not taking anything away from Young, who won a Super Bowl in San Francisco.
Right, he's a Hall of Fame quarterback.
Right. But to answer your question, for some people it'll never happen, and it's not fair to make those comparisons necessarily. They're different kind of players. And certainly after five games, you're not going to make a call like that.
Even if McDougald, for the next, say, 2 years, kept on playing like he is right now, I think it would still be hard for him to shake Cam's shadow. It would.
Yeah, well, he's not playing in it necessarily. There's not going to be a lot of comparing him to him.
Because he's just a different player.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what I think, anyway.
Well, how's that meaningful?
It's not. Just my opinion.
Okay. All right, we're going to eavesdrop. We haven't really listened to that much post-game audio, really nothing from Pete. So I want to do that. Okay. I want to hear about how they handled everything in London and who he thought the star of the game was. Bob Rosen, Tom, we eavesdrop next.
Tango, the line is in. It's time now for the eavesdrop.
Roz, when we sum it up in about 15 minutes, I got a killer stat for you.
I got something to sum it up, too.
Do you?
Yeah.
Awesome, I can't wait.
I really believe you.
Usually on Mondays, we end up eavesdropping on Pete Carroll's morning conversation with Brock and Salk, but alas, that did not happen this morning.
No,
it'll happen tomorrow, I believe, so I'll be sure to bring that to you then. But there was some post-game sound, and Pete just talking about a couple of things, the trip overall to London, and this is probably the most important thing, is that he's just disappointed they couldn't play this well sooner.
I'm more disappointed that we didn't hit it from the first 2 weeks. Sure. You know, I can't go back with looking at this season without regretting the fact that it took us 2 weeks to get rolling. I'm really excited to see where it takes us during this year, and I think we're just picking up kind of a momentum that can really be a factor for us to have a big year. That's the way we're thinking. Our players are thinking that way, and hopefully we'll top it off before the bye with a win here and then keep moving.
Not every good team in the league is going to play great football from start to finish, right, Graz? We know that.
Very few do.
But I did just pull up the Super Bowl history here, all the winners and the runners-up. And if you look at them, just over the last 10 years, for example, most of the teams that have been in the Super Bowl, most, not all, but most, were expected to at least be Super Bowl contenders.
Right.
I wouldn't put the Seahawks in that category this year, even nationally speaking.
No.
Forget about what we think. So, they're 3-3. It's not like they're undefeated, but they're 3-3. They're in good position right now to at least make a wild card, to make a run, to be able to beat anybody. But if they were for some reason to make, if they were able to make it to the Super Bowl, Gross, that'd be a heck of an accomplishment for Pete Carroll. A heck of an accomplishment.
That's understating.
Who now has
the accomplishment of his career?
It really would, just to get there.
Yes.
And congrats to him. Who he passed Mike Holmgren yesterday, 91st all time. Excuse me, 91 wins, first all time. One quick question about that: is there anything from the Pete Carroll era, whether we're talking about the quarterback, the defense, the running back, maybe not the receivers, but coaching, et cetera, that's not the best in the history of the franchise? Don't the Pete Carroll era teams have all of that right now?
Well, I mean, the Chuck Knox era teams had a great running back.
Kurt Warner.
And Dave Craig was a good quarterback. Kenny Easley was a legendary defensive player. Holmgren's teams had tremendous offense. Sean Alexander had the great running back.
They had a better offensive line under Holmgren.
Yeah,
that's for sure.
I think in both cases, Kurt Warner and Sean Alexander are better than any tailbacks that well, Marshawn briefly. Well, not briefly, for 3 or 4 years.
Yeah. I would give the edge to Marshawn. I mean, Alexander is an MVP, but.
Well, I don't know if I'd give Marshawn the edge over those two guys.
Really? I probably would. It's comparable, though.
Yeah.
I don't think it's a landslide either way. Russell Wilson is probably going to get I think he's the best quarterback the team's ever had. Largent's the best wide receiver they've ever had.
So far.
Yeah. I mean, we'll see what Baldwin ends up being, but. Coaching, I mean, Pete Carroll's right there. Holmgren won a Super Bowl in Green Bay, so you could say that. But I think for the most part,
it's the most successful era of Seahawks football.
Yeah, it's the most accomplished for sure.
No doubt. No argument.
How was London, Pete?
The people here love football. I mean, you can't turn out like that. And that's an incredible crowd. It's a big crowd. I don't know, maybe the biggest crowd we played in front of. I don't know. I mean, it's a huge crowd. But they had a blast. I mean, they weren't just there. They were part of it. They contributed. They were involved with it. They were classically there early and having fun with the guys coming on off the field and all of that. This would be a great place to have this home field advantage. And so, you know, whatever the league figures out, I don't know. But there, it looks like it's set up to be the right kind of. It's a great venue.
Did you see the total attendance at Wembley?
84 and change.
God, that is huge. To have 80,000 people in there, and none of them are on the field, obviously. I mean,
right.
That is a monster crowd.
It is a monster crowd. Although I don't agree with Pete about having a team there. Sorry.
Yeah, putting a team there. Yeah, I'm still not on board with that. You know what? If you want to send a team there or two teams there once a year or twice a year or something like that, I guess we're just going to have to live with that.
Four times this year, right?
Does one of them go to Mexico City, one of those games, or is it?
I'm not sure.
It's at least three.
It's at least three.
Yeah, you might be right about the four. And again, it's not going anywhere, but let's not put
it. Let's leave it as it is.
For God's sake. All right, the offensive line, what's up with them playing so well?
Our guys have really come around with and embraced the spirit of it. Dwayne Brown is a tremendous leader. DJ Fluker is just a wild man on the field. Of course, J.R. Sweezy has always been a great attitude guy. You take Britt and Fetty, those guys are just embracing it. Also using Georgie Fan as a tight end so that we can get huge, you know, when we want to there. All with the thought of just continuing to hammer the line of scrimmage, and hopefully we'll get to do that again.
Asked Brady Henderson about who he thought the biggest difference maker on the team is, and Bradley McDougald is certainly a fine candidate for that honor. I think it's actually DJ Fluker.
Well, I mean, him being added to the offensive line seemingly has changed everything.
It's changed, yeah.
I mean, they moved Sweezy over to the other side, and he's been very effective there, and he was ineffective in Fluker's spot, but I'm not going to argue with you. I mean, pre-DJ Fluker, post-DJ Fluker, just look at the numbers.
It's night and day.
It's completely night and day.
Yeah,
it's not being able to run the ball to being one of the most effective teams running the ball.
It's only a couple of games, because really it hasn't been the entire year this way.
No, it's
right?
been three games.
Yeah, to start the year, the first two games were pretty brutal.
Yeah,
actually, and then the Dallas game was basically it.
Yep.
Right, but that's some of the best offensive line play that Pete Carroll has had. Period. That we've seen in these last couple of games
since the Super Bowl champion team. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Absolutely. Frank Clark is now a leader on this team.
He's just turned his outlook in a really, really positive way. He's he's playing as a great teammate. I mean, he's so strong and so supportive with his message. His effort daily, every single day that he practices out there is great. He's taken a leadership role, really reminiscent of some of the guys that were here before. And so almost like he's picked up the mantle and you know, made a statement about that.
Playing behind some of the guys he had to early in his career probably was what delayed his progression to being into whatever you think he is now.
Or maybe he's just hitting his prime right now. He may have learned. He may have picked up some tricks. It may be just a matter of perfect timing. I'm not going to sit here and say that he would have been the exact same player as a rookie that he is right now.
No, but he might have been this player last year.
He could have been.
Yeah, I'm just saying it slowed it.
I'm saying it may have slowed it. It's not automatic that it slowed it. It may have been the perfect configuration of things coming together to create the player that he is this year, because he was not required for him to be on the field for every play, and because he had guys to kind of learn from a little bit. It may have created what he is right now.
My hope is that he's just getting started, right?
Just getting started,
right? What we're seeing isn't his prime. That's still to come. That these are just sort of the beginnings of it.
Well, I mean, he's on pace for.
You think he's going to get more
16 sacks?
You think he's going to reach 16? Because again, sack numbers tend to go up and down.
I'm saying, how much more can you expect from him?
Well, 16 sacks from J.J. Watt would be awesome.
Absolutely, right.
But I don't expect this to continue every single game.
No, but I mean, the way he's playing right now would be fine.
Yes.
This is the beginning of, but I mean, in his prime as we speak.
Another quick comment here about DJ Fluker. We were just talking about him a second ago. This is from Mike Davis.
Fluker, man, he brings the juice. If anybody asks you anything about Fluker, they'll tell you he brings the juice. And he's always hype. He's always live. And, man, he does a great job firing our guys up. So, that's just him.
Is there any aspect of DJ Fluker's life where he doesn't bring the juice?
Not from my limited experience with him.
I mean, he brought the juice.
How about you? He brought the juice on our interview.
Big time. I think that's a funny way to put that.
Fluker, man, he brings the juice.
Who brings the juice around here?
It's 7:10?
I'm going to say you bring a little juice, Tom.
You think so?
Yeah.
I appreciate that.
You bring some juice.
Fire you up a little bit?
You're multitasking.
You don't know the half of it.
I do.
Right, DJ? No, you know. I appreciate that, though.
I mean it.
Yeah. Who else would bring the juice? Brock can bring the juice on. Brock's stretched pretty thin right now, but Brock can bring the juice.
Yes,
Danny
can
definitely bring the juice.
Yes, he can.
Yeah. On a given day. All right. Like I told you, I got a killer stat, and you said you have one for me, too?
Not a killer stat, but I've just got a good parting shot.
All right, good. I'm going to let you go first. Bob Grazenthal next.
It's time to sum it up with Bob Groz and Tom. The final word every day on the show of record at 2:45.
Well, Tom, a legendary career ended today when Bob Robertson called it quits after 52 years.
He's retiring right now?
He's retiring right now, effective immediately. After 52 years of being in Washington State broadcast with a brief foray into the University of Washington games, but since 64, basically, he's been the voice of the Cougars. He also, you may not have known this, was the last guy to do baseball recreation. Stuff that made Ronald Reagan famous.
Okay, yeah.
And actually, Sports Illustrated wrote a piece on him in like 1990. He was doing it for the Spokane Indians at the time, I believe, is who he was doing it for. I had the pleasure of working with Bob for 3 years doing Cougar games, 92 to 95. Had some great ups, very few downs. A true gentleman, a legend. An absolute legend, and I'm hoping his health is good. He said in his retirement announcement that it's just a matter of getting old, and he's retiring immediately but not going away. I hope they have, and I'm sure they will, have some very special remnants of him with ESPN coming in for College Game Day. But
Perfect timing, actually.
Very few guys last that long and are that beloved and have had a career that has spanned so much in one area, and Bob Robertson is that guy, so... Congratulations, Bob, on a tremendous career, and a lot of us are going to miss you. You are truly the absolute legend in this area, and it's kind of, I saw someone tweet out too, boy, losing Bob Rondo and Bob Robertson in the
back-to-back years
is something. But Bob definitely had a unique career and a long career, and I wish him the best.
Man, there are some broadcasters who are so singularly identifiable with one team or with a market. But we're talking 52 years.
52 years.
I mean, when you hang around for 20 years, that's a long time.
That's right.
Right? You become, you're 20, 25, whatever it is. I mean, Riz has been with the Mariners since like 83 with a break in the middle, right,
when
he went to the Tigers. Yeah. But still, I mean, that's a long time. Well, about 30 years.
So think of it in the current context, and it was a great thing that they did on Fox for the Brewers-Dodgers game, is they gave Bob Uecker an inning. And he's a guy, 83 years old now, I think, and identified with the Brewers in that way.
Definitely.
And those guys are the voices of our youth, especially for Bob, you know, doing baseball as well as basketball and football for that matter. You know, he's a voice that a lot of generations grew up with. That's the thing about being a radio voice.
How long do you think it takes the new radio voice, whoever ends up replacing him, to be thought of the same way? Does it take another 20 years?
At least.
30? It really does.
Sure it does.
Because, I mean, you can't, with all due respect to the newer generation of broadcasters, even Joe Buck, he's been doing the World Series since 1996.
Right.
That's 22 years, and I still don't feel like people are comfortable with him. Whether it's because you don't like him.
People still compare him to his old man.
Yeah.
Older folks will.
But even his father never did that many World. His father only did a couple of World Series on television. He did a lot more on the radio.
Yep.
But he'll never be beloved in that same way. I think that there's something about being a broadcaster now that just precludes you from being.
It's about outlets, I think, and the ability to see stuff that you weren't able to see. I mean, for a lot of people, it's really about, you know, and this sounds convenient to say since we're on the radio, but it's about radio that makes you special.
It's a personal medium.
Well, you're right. Television, the picture's already there. I mean, Vin Scully's call of Kirk Gibson's home run. She is gone.
Mm-hmm.
That he didn't have to say anything necessarily.
I think what made that special is that he happened to be the Dodger.
The voice of the Dodgers.
Exactly.
And like I told you, it was the lead up to it that I thought really made it special. But radio is a little bit different. It is more personal. You are painting the picture. And it's not as relied upon as much anymore because everything's on TV nowadays.
Right.
So it's not the same relationship. I mean, in fact, the matter is sports radio has kind of replaced the radio play-by-play in a lot of circumstances. Not all of them. In a lot of circumstances, as the intimate relationship that you used to have.
In terms of when people do listen to the radio, it's more about sports talk radio.
Correct.
Than the play-by-play itself.
Yes. Baseball being to an extent an exception. But remember, I mean, the Mariners, when Dave Niehaus was doing the games, it was the last probably 7 or 8 years that all their games were on TV. When I got here, they had 10 games on TV.
A year?
Yeah. Maybe 20. Then they had road games. They weren't on cable television.
In the 90s, they only put that many games on television?
I got
television?
Here in 1990, yeah.
That's insane.
I mean, they didn't have a cable deal until a couple of years into it here, and it didn't become every game until a while after that.
Well, you're right about one thing. The locally owned, we'll say regional network or team-owned network, that's definitely a thing of the last 15 to 20 years,
it's definitely
max.
Changed the equation.
Right. Before that, it was split between this channel and that channel and cable. You know,
you might have just the road games on for a lot of teams. The Mariners had that situation for a while.
Exactly. Well, anyway, congrats to...
congrats to Bob, Rob. A tremendous career, Bob.
Well, compared to that, this stat may not seem too... I'm just surprised to see this. So game three is tonight for the Brewers and the Dodgers. This is according to MLB. Game three is pivotal when a series is tied 1-1. Okay, obviously. But since 1985, the winner of Game 3 of an LCS moves on what percentage of the time?
I'll say 55.
I thought it was closer to 50. It's 70.
Wow.
70.6% of the time.
In a 1-1 series.
In a 1-1, not when the team's up 2-0, because then Game 3 is different. But if you were asking me which game or how many wins would get you 70%, I'd say maybe that third win of a series.
Game 5. I'd have guessed
right.
Game 5.
Nope. 70% of the time when the series is tied 1-1, the team that wins Game 3 goes on to win it. That is surprising to me.
Very surprising. So it's a big game is what you're telling me tonight.
Yeah, well, 70% of the time it's a big game.
We'll see if tonight's the night and if the Dodgers can take advantage of good juju tonight. 30th anniversary of Gibson's home run.
I thought you meant Juju Smith-Schuster.
No, I did not.
What does he have to do with it?
He's playing tonight too, though. Isn't he a Packer?
No, he's a Steeler.
Oh, sorry about that.
They beat Cincinnati.
Clinton Dix is a pack.
Ha ha, Clinton Dix.
Is that right?
Yes, he is.
Yeah, okay. I knew they had some.
Or at least was.
Yeah, he might not be anymore.
I don't know. One other quick, crazy stat. Last night at the end of the game, the Patriots won that game 43-40.
Yep.
Al Michaels came on and said, that's the only time in NFL history a game's ever ended with that score.
Isn't that bizarre?
That is nuts. I mean, you'd think maybe if a game ended 5-4, you'd be like, all right, well, that's never happened.
But 100 years of NFL, it's never been
43-40. 43-40, it's never happened, ever.
Bizarre.
Mind-blowing. We're back tomorrow with El Hombre, etc., etc. I'm Bob Grosenthal.